The U.S. economy is growing at less than 3% a year.
Why is the rate so lackluster, and could it get worse?
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. It's the Midday Update from Marketplace.org, our podcast, and it's Friday, February 25th. Happy Friday, Jeremy.
Happy Friday, Steve.
Coming up, chaos in Libya forces a mass exodus of workers. Is it time to restart deepwater drilling in the Gulf of Mexico?
Also, police think they've whacked the whack-a-mole software virus guy. Those stories are straight ahead, right here on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
We start this morning with the latest revised numbers on economic growth. The government today said the U.S. economy only grew at a rate of 2.8% last quarter, after originally reporting it grew at 3.2%.
Bruce McCain is chief investment strategist at Key Private Bank. He's with us now from Cleveland. Good morning.
Good morning.
So 2.8%, despite all the help from the Fed and from the lingering effects of the stimulus package, is this the best we can do?
We think it is quite possible that we don't see a lot stronger growth as the sluggish recovery we've seen so far continues. Even worse, we're somewhat concerned that with the possibility of sharply rising energy prices, that will complicate household budgets and wear on consumer confidence, so personal consumption may not remain as strong as it was in the fourth quarter. And that even worse, some of the rising interest rates we've seen in China, the political and economic turmoil in other emerging markets around the world, may also limit U.S. export growth going forward in a way that will make it hard for exports to drive business spending here the way they have over the course of the last year or so.
And Bruce, does this number, this disappointing number, change the debate at all in Washington about cutting spending and perhaps at the Fed, which is facing criticism for its stimulative efforts?
Well, it certainly fuels the argument that the Fed's made that we have to focus on the slow growth. But to this point, they've had the luxury of focusing slowly on the slow growth we've seen within the economy. As you see rising energy prices increasingly, they may be forced to deal with the inflationary side of their mandate. And particularly for companies that have been hard-pressed by rising commodity prices and input prices,
right,
you may start to see more sharply rising costs in business. And ultimately, I think the Fed may find they have more of a stagflationary problem that they have to consider than simply the problem of slow growth.
Bruce McCain, chief investment strategist at Key Private Bank.
And worries, Jeremy, about gas prices might make the economic recovery even more fragile this year. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large for CBS MoneyWatch, and she's with us from New York, as she is every Friday. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
How disappointed should we be with that downward revision?
Well, you know, of course it's a disappointment. We don't like things cut. But the bigger disappointment may be that our overall growth rate really makes this a pretty pokey recovery. Historically, after recessions, we usually see the economy grow by more like 4 or 5%, and we are hardly at those robust levels this time around.
All right, so that's bad enough. But we've seen these oil prices up nearly 10% for the week because of everything going on in the Middle East and North Africa. How's that going to affect the economy going forward this year?
If gas costs more, consumers will have less money to spend elsewhere. Then perhaps companies don't make as much money. Maybe they hold back on job creation. You know, this is vicious cycle kind of stuff. But it really has to be that prices stay high enough.
What happened the last time we saw gas? And I remember a few years back, right, when oil was way above $100 a barrel. I mean, what happened when gas prices were so high?
Well, you know, that was the summer of 2008, and gas prices were $4.11 nationally.
Yeah.
It was a huge number. Frankly, that coincided with the recession. It probably helped to contribute to it. I mean, I know we had a whole crisis that was financial, but that was really a tipping point where consumers started to say, whoa, I can't spend on anything. This is too much. And you also saw the car sales plummet after that. If gas prices are up, this really does not portend well for them.
Jill Schlesinger from CBS MoneyWatch. Thanks.
Great to be with you.
To Libya now. The UN's top human rights official is calling for the international community to step in vigorously after reports of mass killings of anti-government protesters. Today, NATO will meet to discuss possible military action, and European governments are moving to freeze the assets of Libya's leader, Muammar Gaddafi. He's suspected of stashing billions of dollars in assets outside the country. Marketplace's Stephen Beer joins us from London, which is one of these suspected hideouts, to discuss. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So tell us, who's freezing what?
The Swiss have frozen any assets owned by the Gaddafi family held in Switzerland. Switzerland is the haven, of course, for loot, dictators' loot. But Gaddafi had a furious row with the Swiss 3 years ago, and he may have taken all his money out of the country. The real focus of attention is London. It's the traditional playground for rich Arabs. Saif Gaddafi, his son, is known to have a $15 million mansion here. And there are stories circulating that Gaddafi could have tens of billions invested here in fairly liquid assets.
So, Stephen, what are the British authorities doing about that?
Well, they set up a unit to trace Gaddafi's assets in Britain. Now, of course, he's not going to wait around for his assets to be frozen, but they may effectively have already been frozen. Tim Daniel, a lawyer who specialises in asset tracking, says the British authorities sent out a warning more than a week ago to all banks and brokers and lawyers to be very careful about handling property with Gaddafi's fingerprints on it.
Although it's not a formal freezing of assets, I think that any responsible banking organization would think very hard before transferring any money out of these accounts if they knew it to be connected with Libya, and particularly with the Gaddafi family.
The British government's taken a lot of heat in recent days, especially from the US, for having allegedly sucked up to Gaddafi, releasing the Lockerbie bomber, for example. It seems the UK now wants to make amends and stop the Gaddafi billions disappearing into the ether.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London.
And a ferry with hundreds of Americans on board is scheduled to leave Libya, Jeremy, at some point today. Meanwhile, other countries are also getting their workers out. Eyewitnesses along the border say tens of thousands of Egyptians and others are returning home. As we continue Marketplace's Mideast coverage, the BBC's Alistair Leithead is with us from Cairo with the latest. Hello, Alistair.
Hi there.
We're hearing stories of all these foreign workers fleeing Libya. Why were they there in the first place?
Well, there are a lot of opportunities for workers in Libya. Certainly in the oil industry, that's why you have a lot of people from the West working there. But also within the region itself, there's been a lot of opportunity as well. And countries such as Tunisia and Egypt, both neighbours, both suffer from high unemployment themselves. And there's a sense that there was more opportunity in Libya. And so a lot of people have gone there. 1.5 million Egyptians are normally based in Libya, according to the foreign ministry here in Cairo.
How will the loss of all those workers change the economy there in Libya?
Well, I think the question at the moment is what the economy is doing in Libya because of the political crisis, because of the violence that we've seen. That's going to have a big impact on the country anyway. There is high unemployment in Libya as it is. There is a lot of poverty in certain areas. And I think the anger that we've seen really shows that. And of course, what will happen if Colonel Gaddafi decides to shut down the oil fields or set fire to them when he goes? There's lots of unknowns at the moment affecting Libya. And of course, the economy is a very important part of that.
The BBC's Alistair Leithead in Cairo. Alistair, thanks.
Thanks.
The Wisconsin State Assembly passed that anti-union measure early this morning. The bill now goes to the state Senate, but Senate Democrats remain out of state to prevent a vote.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac say they lost nearly $4 billion in the last quarter of 2010, and each has asked for more money, billions of dollars, and more money in federal aid.
Video gamers in Tokyo are getting ready for tomorrow's launch of Nintendo's new 3D handheld game player. You don't need special glasses to use it, Steve, so you won't have to worry about a bunch of people walking around with 3D players and those special glasses on. You won't even know who's
bumping
playing
into things. Yeah.
But the 3DS, as it's called, launches here in the US next month.
For more numbers, stocks, and a lot of other ones, check out the numbers section at our website, marketplace.org. You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, February 25th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. Now more of the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world.
Well, voters in Ireland are choosing a new government today. The elections come just months after a bailout from the European Union and the International Monetary Fund worth more than $100 billion. And as Christopher Wirth reports, the results of the vote could reopen questions about the terms of that bailout.
Ireland's faltering economy has dominated the campaign trail and political ads.
A country in crisis. Average people paying the price.
Ben Tonra is a political scientist at University College Dublin who's been following the election closely.
I think the Irish public, first of all, is frightened.
Frightened, he says, by a growing sense that Ireland is no longer fully in control of its own economic affairs after being bailed out by the rest of Europe.
We have literally the EU and the IMF looking over our shoulders. Really, it's a cause of national humiliation.
Two political parties, long in opposition, say it's time to reclaim Ireland's pride and independence. The parties Fine Gael and Labour are thought likely to form the next government.
Both have said very, very clearly that the deal that was negotiated by the previous Irish government has to be renegotiated.
The parties also say they want other European countries to share the burden of Ireland's growing debt, which is skyrocketing because the Irish government has guaranteed the hundreds of billions of dollars poured into the country's failing banks.
It's the amount of debt that could crush this country beyond repair.
Peter Matthews is a candidate for Fine Gael in Dublin. He says the money used to prop up Ireland's financial system is also preventing losses at other European banks that lent irresponsibly to banks in Ireland. But as it stands, Matthews says, Irish taxpayers are footing the entire bill for a problem they didn't create.
Therefore, there's no moral reason why they should be forced to take the responsibility of repaying that debt.
His party says if it's elected, it will try to restructure that debt by forcing investors in the big banks to take their losses, a move the European countries that bailed out Ireland are adamantly opposed to. They fear it could set a precedent for a string of bank defaults across Europe. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
The number of deaths in New Zealand could top 400 after a powerful earthquake this week near the city of Christchurch. Now, American engineers are descending on New Zealand to measure damage and, more importantly, to learn how to better protect buildings, sewers, and the like against earthquakes in cities here in the United States. But Marketplace's Eve Troe asks, will those cities listen?
Richer nations like New Zealand tend to fare better in earthquakes than poorer ones. Brian Tucker is with the nonprofit Geohazards International. He says that's thanks to public funding.
Research and development in how to improve the building code, enacting the building code, and then enforcing it through government agencies.
That doesn't take a lot of money, says Tucker, but governments have to make it a priority. And in places that haven't felt a quake in a long time, like the Midwest on the New Madrid Fault, reinforcing buildings isn't high on the list. Tom Tobin at the Earthquake Engineering Research Institute says strapped local governments are thinking short-term. Earthquake readiness is a long-term issue.
It requires a consistent stream of funding, absolutely. Implementing a program over decades in order to make it work.
Tobin says U.S. roads, sewers, and gas lines are already in bad shape. Cuts to ambulance service or emergency hotlines will mean cities can't respond as quickly to quakes. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
In Florida today, executives with America's biggest household products companies are wrapping up a meeting with stock analysts. Companies such as Procter & Gamble and Clorox are trying to clean up their acts for investors, but that task is going to require a little elbow grease, if you will, because of rising costs for the stuff that goes into their products. Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore explains.
After the housing crisis, we may have a house cleaning crisis. Companies that make detergent and toothpaste are paying more for petroleum and other commodities. Procter & Gamble, for one, says its costs will jump by $1 billion this year. The good news is Procter & Gamble won't be passing on all of that to consumers.
I think you're going to see modestly higher prices on household products.
That's Lauren DeSanto, who covers Procter & Gamble for Morningstar. She spoke to us from the conference where analysts are fretting about the future of consumer companies. She says they can't raise prices too much for strap shoppers because they'll balk at $4 toothpaste. So Procter & Gamble will just have to make less money.
It's going to be a huge hit on their bottom line.
That will disappoint shareholders. But in the toughest position of all are retailers like Walmart, who guarantee low prices to shoppers. That's a hard promise to keep these days. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
To San Francisco now, where snow is in the forecast today,
what?
Steve.
What?
That's right. And to give you a sense of how unusual that is, think of this. It has only snowed 3 times in San Francisco in the last 120 years.
Oh, wow.
And the last time it snowed was back in the 70s. Now, I'm about to become a California resident.
Yes, you are.
And you are a California resident. Yeah. We both know the state is in a bit of a budget problem.
Yes, we do. well so reported, Jeremy.
Yes, thank you. Here's an idea, though, that they might consider from an outsider. Okay. Skiing on Lombard Street, the famously crooked slopes of Lombard Street in San Francisco. And they've already got ski lifts. Those trolleys can take you right up back to the top of the hill.
Cars. It'd be like a big frozen Rice-A-Roni commercial.
And by the way, Steve, I don't think that San Francisco is going to have any problem coming up with the après ski. You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, February 25th. Happy Friday. Happy Friday, Steve.
Thank you. To you too, Jeremy.
Thank you. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis, also known as Radio Chio on Twitter.
Well, the U.S. Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, will be in Houston today meeting with oil industry executives. They want deepwater drilling to be restarted in the Gulf of Mexico. It's been on hold since the BP oil spill. Well, Secretary Salazar wants to find out if the industry has figured out how to contain any future oil spill. For more on this story, let's bring in Barbara Shook. She's with the Energy Intelligence Group in Houston. Good morning.
Good morning.
So is the industry ready to start deep water drilling again and perhaps more importantly, to handle a spill?
Yes, I think they are. Last week, five major oil companies introduced the equipment that they believe will be able to contain a subsea blowout. And I think they're ready to go, and they've done this in less than a year. And I think that demonstrates that the industry can respond quickly and in the best-case scenario.
And how badly do oil companies need to be able to drill in the deep water in the Gulf? What's at stake for the companies?
Outside of Brazil and West Africa, this is the best opportunity that they have for large oil deposits that are not controlled by national oil companies. And they've made discoveries that they cannot develop. And these are very important to the U.S. The U.S. in the last 3 or 4 years has seen its oil production plateau instead of decline. And if we want to remain in that situation, which I think is becoming even more critical with the unrest in North Africa and the Middle East, we have to get back into the Gulf of Mexico.
Barbara Shook, Houston Bureau Chief for the Energy Intelligence Group, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Always a pleasure.
And saving the best for last, Steve, this is my favorite story of the morning.
Yeah.
CBS says its most popular show, in fact, the most popular sitcom on TV, is officially on hiatus until further notice.
Oh, boy.
This is because actor Charlie Sheen had an outburst on the radio. You're going to hear a bit of it in a minute. And it means that CBS has to stop production of Two and a Half Men for the rest of the season. Marketplace's Janet Babin has this incredible report on what it means for CBS's competition.
CBS canceled the season after this bizarre rant from Charlie Sheen on the Alex Jones radio show. Here's what Sheen had to say about the show's creator.
I've spent, I think, close to the last decade, I don't know, effortlessly and magically converting your tin cans into pure gold. And the gratitude I get is this charlatan chose not to do his job, which is to write.
The show is the top-rated sitcom on TV right now. Other networks will probably try to capitalize on the hole in CBS's Monday night lineup. But Porter Bibb at MediaTek Capital Partners says try is the operative verb here.
Sure, the Charlie Sheen episode is going to leave a small gap, but I don't believe that there's going to be much room for anybody else to slip in between the hit shows that CBS is broadcasting today.
CBS makes about $1 million in bottom line profits from each episode of Two and a Half Men, so it's not likely to let the show go gently into that good night. Bibb expects the network will replace Sheen next season. Viewers might notice, he says, but he doesn't expect they'll mind much. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
From Charlie Sheen, Jeremy, to whack-a-moles.
Okay, good. I like where this is going.
But perhaps he could take a little bit of his frustration out on one of these games. I don't know. But police in Orlando, Florida, arrested a man for planting a computer virus in the software of all of those whack-a-mole games you see at the arcade, right? Or Chuck E. Cheese. Yeah, I mean, they're all over the place, right? And they give out those tickets. It's a great stress reliever. It is for me anyway, because you take the hammer and you're like, boom, and it boom. And so that's right. Do it over there in New York, too. The mole pops out and you smack it back down. Well, authorities say Marvin Wimberly rigged the technology to fail on purpose because he wanted to keep his job and he wanted to make sure that, you know, everybody needed him and he was going to get paid more money to solve this problem. I wonder how many of those game redemption tickets he's going to need to post bond.
Oh!
You saw that coming from a mile away, didn't you?
I like it.
Happy Friday. Jeremy, I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York, but next time you hear from me in a week, I will be in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
Bring your surfboard.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.